So you may feel it, but you have to push beyond it because the work you are setting out to do is so important that you can't allow the feeling to hold you back. And so I love the phrase without fear, because it's not saying that fear doesn't exist. It's simply saying that it should not be the barrier, that you can feel it, but you have to move beyond it when you're looking at the larger picture here, which is to bring about meaningful change for all people. So we need that message today. There are so many reasons to feel fearful with everything that's going on across the nation and the globe.
Let's talk for a moment and zero in on what your message is going to be to the audience in Oregon when you come here. And tell me about your talk, what you're planning to focus on.
I'm planning to talk about Black women and the struggle for human rights in U.S. history, drawing on the original research that I've done to produce my latest book.
Do you think that there is a quelling of voices right now going on because of the anti-DEI push of the current administration, and especially when it comes to academia and some universities have capitulated and given into this? And is there a danger of losing a lot of knowledge that we've accumulated about our America's real history?
Yes, unfortunately, I have witnessed far too many academics who study similar topics. I've seen them silenced. I've seen job opportunities simply disappear because searches are canceled and someone's afraid to move forward with plans to hire a professor who might teach courses on Black people or any other marginalized group in this country.
Thanks for joining us here on the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 5th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings, Josh Salem, and Isabel Charlet.
The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto.
Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, to discuss some of the latest arts news from our region. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Let's get into it. First up, a story about the future of Broadway-style venues in Portland. This story by Jim Redden is called Plan for Two-Venue Keller Auditorium PSU Performing Arts Center Challenged. Get us up to speed. What's the latest here?
A new market feasibility study declares that the city can't support both the 3,000-seat Keller and a new large hall at Portland State University, but it favors the PSU project. And the lead sentence in this story kind of really, really lays it out. The future of downtown Portland's performing arts scene has been thrown into disarray. And that really is the case in a way. So to provide some background, The Portland officials released this market feasibility study on January 23rd, and this was kind of upended a proposal that was approved by the Portland City Council in late 2024 that wanted the two facilities, one at Keller and one at Portland State. And so just to rehash a bit about the backstory that led to this study, the Keller Auditorium needs to close for up to 2 years to be renovated and allow for seismic upgrades because it does not meet current earthquake codes. But the city needs to maintain some form of a large venue capable of holding big performances like Broadway touring productions, because they are a huge economic driver. Broadway shows help to pay for a lot of the other public performing arts spaces. They also hire a lot of local people who depend on those jobs. And those spaces are also really important for local large performing arts organizations like Portland Opera and Oregon Ballet Theater. So it would be a major disruption if Portland did not have at least one large venue. And so knowing that the Keller needed to be upgraded, they've known this for about 10 years, they've been considering various options and trying to figure out how to move forward. And Portland State submitted a proposal some months back that was a game changer, that they would build a large performance space on campus plus another smaller space and provide some other amenities. So the council voted on this plan in late 2024 that they would build the PSU site and remodel the Keller so Portland would be able to have at least one large facility while the Keller was being remodeled. And then after the Keller was finished, they would have two large facilities. And the Keller has staunch supporters because it has historical significance. It's married in a way to the significant Keller fountain across the street, and that fountain is part of a sequence of seven fountains. So there's a whole history there. But this new feasibility study says that there would not be enough ticket demand to maintain two venues, and it favors the PSU plan. So this puts the fate of the Keller Auditorium into question, and there are calls to reimagine that space. So we'll see how all of that develops.
It's very interesting. And the piece also gets into who the decision makers are in this case, right? The previous city council is the one that went ahead with studying, you know, this two venue option, but we haven't seen the new council weigh in just yet. Do we have any idea of how they might feel about this plan?
Yeah, I'm not sure yet. There are definitely different factions that come into play here. People have a variety of interests and opinions. So there will, you know, the whole process, it's been a long, you know, figuring out process. And so we'll still have to see where it goes. But this feasibility study, yeah, it kind of throws a firecracker into the situation, and I'm really not sure what the council will figure out. They have a lot of things on their plate, and because there are now 12 members, it's a lot of, you know, a variety of opinions they have to sort through, so I'm not really sure where they're going to land yet.
I know some of the comments that I've seen from folks reacting to this news, you know, of course, mourning the Keller a bit because it has been such a Portland institution, but also thinking about this possible reimagining of the Keller maybe as a different type of performing arts space. But is there really room for that or an appetite for that kind of venue in Portland, what with all the other venue construction that is currently happening?
Yeah, there are other venues that are being built, and the Keller is not that friendly for big productions, to be honest. And so it's not an ideal performing art facility the way it is now, and people were kind of looking forward to, you know, rethinking it so that it would be more accommodating to actually, you know, the people who work there and have to deal with it, and to be able to enjoy performances that where you don't feel like you're in such a huge, you know, hangar or something. But because there are ways to make venues more inviting for everybody. So I am curious. There were plans, one of the ideas that had floated around would be a new James Beard Market, but now that is decided on a different location. And we'll just have to see what comes of this. I'm sure, on the other hand, disruption is an opportunity for, something new and exciting. So, that it doesn't mean that it's going to be something terrible. It could be something really new and thrilling. I don't know. We'll have to see.
That's an important perspective to weave in here. Well, I want to ask you about another story ArtsWatch did about the end of the Oregon Trail Center in Oregon City, which is planning big improvements to its museum and cultural center. What's happening there?
Yeah, speaking of another venue, the end of the Oregon Trail Center in Oregon City is planning a major restoration work and looking to revitalize the whole campus. It's a popular attraction and important education and history center. Lots of students go there on field trips and learn about the Oregon Trail and what it was like for people who lived then. It attracts a lot of visitors, more than a million visitors a year. So it's hugely popular. And our story on this had huge readership, which really speaks to its popularity. But the center is now 30 years old. It has deteriorated in that time. And when it was built, it did not include the historical perspectives of different communities. So this whole new jumpstart now for all this renewal happened with a donation of 26 original wagons from the Curtis family. And the center needs to figure out how they're going to house and protect those wagons. And they're using this opportunity to reimagine the campus. They're calling it a re-envisioning. It's now going to include a plank house with input from indigenous communities. It is planning to install a new exhibit in partnership with Oregon Black Pioneers. It will have an amphitheater and expanded programming. So lots of plans are in the works for the center, and they're aiming to have all the renovations completed in 2030.
That is really exciting, and it's interesting to see how the end of the Oregon Trail Center has evolved over time, right? Because some of these different perspectives were not included in their original plan. And also interesting how the Trail Center has weathered the years, that there's been multiple instances of kind of falling into disrepair and having to build back up.
Yeah, the big storms. Yeah, there's a big sort of a wagon-looking structure at the entrance, and when it was built, it had canvases over it. Well, those deteriorated and blew off in a storm, so it really does need a lot of restoration work. And again, this is disruption leads to opportunities for something new and exciting. So it's also important, like you noted, how history changes over time, our perspective changes, and who gets to set the historical record? It's good to question what we think of as history and who's telling those stories. So it's nice to see that after 30 years that people are thinking in fresh, more inclusive ways how to incorporate the stories from many people and many perspectives.
ArtsWatch is also tracking Oregon's celebration of Black History Month, which, of course, just started this week. What should folks be on the lookout for?
Yeah, just that there are a lot of events happening. February is Black History Month, so it's a lot is happening around Oregon. Alberta Abbey is having a show called The Weary Blues with a lot of well-known musicians. It's an evening of live poetry and jazz, which sounds lovely. The Passenart Theater Company is producing Sojourner at its facility, and I believe that will open in a few weeks. And the Portland Art Museum is recently established Black Art and Experience Galleries when they also renovated and reopened. And Oregon Black Pioneers has several online exhibits. So there are just lots of ways to be able to experience Black history. You know, we were just talking about the variety of history and from different perspectives. And so there are lots of events around where people can learn about a variety of Black history events.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find out more information about these different Arts Watch stories we've talked about?
People can read all these stories and a lot more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
That was Laura Grimes, the executive director at Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the latest arts news from our region. More information is online at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Venezuela's leader has her own agenda. Spain offers new hope for migrant workers. And the last remaining U.S.-Russia nuclear arms agreement is in jeopardy. First, Venezuela's leader has her own agenda. Ties between the Trump administration and its hand-picked Venezuelan leader, Delay Rodriguez, may be fraying. Trump had said he would run the country. Rodriguez now says, quote, "We are not afraid, nor are we afraid of maintaining respectful relations with the United States, but they must be based on respect. Respect for international law, basic human respect in interpersonal relations, and respect for the dignity and history of Venezuela." Enough already, she said, of Washington's orders over politicians in Venezuela. Let Venezuelan politics resolve our differences and our internal conflicts. This republic has paid a very high price for having to confront the consequences of fascism and extremism in our country. Reporting by the Wall Street Journal suggests that Rodriguez is planning on waiting Trump out, confident that once he's out of office, his unpopular Venezuela policy will be reversed. Her broader strategy, said current and former U.S. officials and the Venezuelan opposition, aims to outlast Trump's focus on her country by giving ground on demands that benefit her, such as allowing foreign investment in oil and other areas, while slow-walking political concessions that would lead to real change, such as releasing all political prisoners. The ultimate goal, says the Wall Street Journal article, is to preserve her position. Trump professes to be unaware of what Rodriguez is saying or doing. He still says she is a terrific person. How long she remains terrific may well depend on whether Venezuela sells its oil exclusively to the U.S., as Trump has demanded, or sells to U.S. unapproved customers, such as Russia, China, and Iran. One thing is certain about U.S. control of Venezuela's oil: the oil companies have the most favorable conditions for investing. Venezuela's legislature gave Trump nearly everything he wanted. To be sure, Exxon and perhaps a few other companies still worry about being nationalized, as happened when Hugo Chavez ruled. But the new legislation in Venezuela gives foreign oil companies operational control, which most likely means lower taxes and a higher percentage of royalties. No wonder Trump is being pressured by Democrats about profiteering from Venezuelan oil sales. Good luck on that. Spain offers new hope for migrant workers. In sharp contrast with the immigration policies of its neighbors and the United States, the Spanish government is offering hundreds of thousands of migrant workers living in the country an opportunity to apply for renewable residency permits. The government of Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, a socialist, described the measure as critical to Spain's economic future. Spain's Minister for Migration said it would have an impact, quote, "on our social cohesion, well-being, and also on the economy." Figures on the number of migrant workers affected by the new policy are vague. They could be anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million. These workers must prove that they arrived in Spain before December 2025, that they have lived in the country for at least 5 months, and that they have no criminal record. Spain's far right, using Trumpian language, says the policy could lead to an invasion. Our third top story, the last remaining U.S.-Russia nuclear arms agreement is in jeopardy. Unless Donald Trump changes his mind, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, called New START, will expire February 6. Its expiration might lead to production and deployment of new nuclear weapons beyond the current limit of 1,500 for each side, as well as testing of those weapons. Such steps would spell the end of nuclear arms control, including not just the treaty, but also the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which binds the 190 signatories not to acquire nuclear weapons and binds the nuclear weapon states to move toward nuclear disarmament. Amelia Lester writes for Foreign Policy magazine, quote, Russian President Vladimir Putin recently suggested that both sides could stick to the rules for another 12 months. But last month, Trump said of the 2010 treaty, quote, I'd rather do a new agreement, that's much better. But no negotiations are underway, and Trump also hinted last October that the United States could begin testing nuclear weapons again. In other news, the Greenland story, far from over. Jeff Landry, the Trump administration's envoy to Greenland, he's also governor of Louisiana, has written an op-ed for the New York Times that tells us the U.S. intends to dominate the island. Quote, when President Trump took office last year, he recognized an uncomfortable fact that many others have avoided. America must guarantee its own unfettered and uninterrupted access to key strategic territories in the Western Hemisphere, including both Greenland and the Panama Canal. It is no accident that he put those two locations together, since, quote, Greenland fits squarely within the idea behind the Monroe Doctrine for Latin America. Thus, now that a framework for a future deal is supposedly in place for Greenland, the U.S. will use it to, in Landry's words, quote, set the rules in one of the world's most strategically consequential regions in perpetuity. American dominance in the Arctic is non-negotiable, writes Landry. Greenland is a core national security interest for the United States, repeating what Trump said at the World Economic Forum in Davos. That's an extraordinary statement, considering the many other global security interests Trump and his predecessors have identified. And it's a wrong assessment based on Cold War thinking. The Chinese and Russian activities in and around Greenland hardly amount to a national security threat. Contrary to Trump, in a January 9 press conference, there are no Chinese and Russian destroyers circling Greenland, nor are there Russian submarines all over the place, nor, finally, are there any indications that Russia or China plans to occupy Greenland. But there are Russian and Chinese fishing boats. Nevertheless, the U.S. is going to build more bases in Greenland, establish a Golden Dome missile defense there, build more icebreakers, and vigorously patrol the Arctic waters to prevent a Russian or Chinese takeover. These plans, proposed in the name of national defense, conceal a long-term design on Greenland and especially its mineral resources. Trump conducts economic warfare against Cuba. Following up on Marco Rubio's threats to Cuba, the island's oil imports are drying up. Trump has made sure Venezuelan oil is no longer available, threatening to raise tariffs on any country that might provide it. Cuba's usual sources of oil, Mexico and Angola among them, are being closed down, almost certainly under U.S. pressure. Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum insists the decision is a sovereign one and that Mexico will continue to provide oil as humanitarian assistance. But when we consider that Trump has threatened to go after drug cartels in Mexico and that the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement is up for renewal shortly, it is hard to credit Sheinbaum's claim. Trump has made clear the U.S. aim with Cuba, an economic blockade. Cuba will be failing pretty soon, he boasted. Indeed, by some estimates, Cuba has only about 3 weeks of oil left, after which a humanitarian crisis is being predicted. Diesel is essential to electricity, transportation, water delivery, and agriculture. During the Cold War, the U.S. economic blockade of Cuba was based on Cuba's support of revolutionary movements in Latin America and Africa. Now the pretext is that Cuba is a national security threat because it provides, quote, a safe haven for transnational terrorist groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas. No evidence has been offered in support of this charge, and I doubt any evidence exists. The U.S. may be supporting Canadian separatists. Last week, I reported on remarks by U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent that suggested support for a separatist movement in Alberta. That support apparently extends to the highest level of the U.S. government, according to an account in the Daily Beast. Very, very senior officials in the Trump administration have had secret meetings with far-right Canadian separatists trying to shake the foundations of the country, the Daily Beast reports. The covert meetings between high-ranking U.S. officials and the Alberta Prosperity Project have met U.S. State Department officials in Washington, D.C. three times in the last 9 months, end quote. One member of that project who attended the meeting said, quote, "The U.S. is extremely enthusiastic about a free and independent Alberta. We're meeting very, very senior people, leaving our meetings to go directly to the Oval Office," he claimed. The group is hoping to place a referendum on independence on the ballot, but that has not happened so far. U.S. officials deny any support of this movement, but the State Department acknowledges that meetings did take place. The very fact that U.S. officials would engage with Canadian separatists is a shocking level of interference in Canadian affairs and shows just how far Trump is willing to go with his dream of making Canada the 51st state. Trump renews threats to Iran. Once again, President Trump is threatening to attack Iran. Just a few weeks ago, the threat turned on Iran's reaction to massive protests and the possible execution of protesters. "The U.S. was locked and loaded," said Trump. "Protesters could count on the United States." But Trump was evidently persuaded by Arab countries and the U.S. military not to attack. Now Trump, having failed to back up his promises as thousands of protesters were killed or jailed, is saying Iran has revitalized its nuclear weapons capability. That's the capability he had claimed was obliterated in U.S. attacks on Iran last June. Trump has ordered the U.S. military to the Middle East, saying that, like with Venezuela, it is ready, willing, and able to rapidly fulfill its mission with speed and violence if necessary, unquote. News reports indicate Trump is considering various options, including putting U.S. troops on the ground in Iran. Evidently, Trump has become so enamored with the successful seizure of Maduro in Venezuela that he thinks Iran can be easily dealt with. Yet, Trump also says he hopes to avoid the use of force. In short, more gunboat diplomacy. Iran is responding, as in the past, with threats of its own and offers to talk. If the U.S. attacks, Iran says it will respond with attacks on Israel and U.S. bases in the region. But Iran's foreign minister also said Iran was, quote, ready to begin negotiations if they take place on an equal footing, based on mutual interests and mutual respect. As to the agenda, the minister said, quote, "Iran's defensive and missile capabilities will never be subject to negotiation." In the past, Iran has also said its nuclear enrichment program is off the bargaining table. That point collides with the demand made recently by Steve Witkoff, Trump's special Middle East envoy, that Iran stop its enrichment program altogether and transfer all its enriched uranium out of the country. The latest news is that Witkoff and, naturally, Jared Kushner are about to meet with the foreign minister tomorrow. Ukraine sees progress in talks with Russia, but huge obstacles remain. Ukraine's negotiators see progress in talks with their Russian counterparts, mainly because the quality of the Russian negotiators is higher than before. Nevertheless, no progress has been made on territorial issues, the status of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, or security guarantees for Ukraine after a settlement. The Washington Post reports that, quote, "officials involved in the talks said Trump was pressuring Ukraine to concede territory before he would agree to signing the security agreement." President Zelensky says the agreement is ready for Trump's signature, and that the agreement would have to include a legally binding obligation from the U.S. Congress. The Russians oppose any security guarantees for Ukraine. Its foreign minister said, quote, "such security guarantees are unlikely to ensure lasting peace." Finally, some updates. First, from Israel. Israel has always challenged casualty reports by the Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas. Now the Israeli Defense Forces have accepted the Health Administration's estimate that approximately 71,000 Palestinians were killed during the war, noting that that number does not include missing people who are potentially buried under rubble. And the number keeps increasing. Over 500 Palestinians have been killed so far in the IDF's ongoing attacks in Gaza. As Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said, the second phase of the ceasefire is merely declarative. And from Myanmar, national elections held in December and January gave the military junta, as expected, a mandate to continue its dictatorship. It supposedly won 80% of the vote, enabling military officers to dominate parliament. Pro-democracy parties were not allowed to run. Aung San Suu Kyi, whose National League for Democracy won in landslides in 2015 and 2020, remains in solitary confinement. Neither of Myanmar's big neighbors, India and China, criticized these sham elections. And finally from Washington, President Trump has put up a picture of Putin in the Palm Room of the White House near the West Wing. Trump thinks Putin looks nice in the photo, which includes the two of them at their disastrous Alaska summit. Now, what does that picture, which is placed above one of Trump and a granddaughter, tell us about Trump's leanings? And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO